Chapter 12. The Papal Temporal Power Established. We have seen how that by the arrogant ministry of Leo, the Bishop of Rome was made the fountain of faith and was elevated to a position of dignity and authority that the aspiring prelacy had never before attained. For Leo, as the typical pope, was one whose ambition knew no bounds, and to gratify it, he stuck at nothing, made no distinction between right and wrong, between truth and falsehood, as if he had adopted the famous maxim of Julius Caesar, "Be just, unless a kingdom tempts to break the laws, for sovereign power alone can justify the cause," or thought the most criminal actions ceased to be criminal and became meritorious, when any ways subservient to the increase of his power or the exaltation of his see. Nor was the force of any single point of his example ever lost upon his successors. His immediate successor, Hilary, 461 to 467, was so glad to occupy the place which had been made so large by Leo, that shortly after his election, he wrote a letter to the other bishops asking them to exult with him, taking particular care in the letter to tell them that he did not doubt that they all knew what respect and deference was paid in the Spirit of God to Saint Peter and his see. The bishops of Spain addressed him as the successor of Saint Peter, whose primacy ought to be loved and feared by all. Hilary was succeeded by Simplicius, 467 to 483, in whose pontificate the empire perished when the Heruli, under Odoacer, overran all Italy, deposed the last emperor of the West, appropriated to themselves one-third of all the lands, and established the Herulian kingdom with Odoacer as king of Italy. In fact, the more imperial power faded, and the nearer the empire approached its fall, the more rapidly and the stronger grew the papal assumptions. Thus the very calamities which rapidly wrought the ruin of the empire, and which were hastened by the union of church and state, were turned to the advantage of the bishopric of Rome. During the whole period of barbarian invasions from 400 to 476, the Catholic hierarchy everywhere adapted itself to the situation, and reaped power and influence from the calamities that were visited everywhere. We have seen that Innocent I, upon whose mind there appears first to have dawned the vast conception of Rome's universal ecclesiastical supremacy, during the invasion of Italy and the siege of Rome by Alaric, headed an embassy to the emperor to mediate for a treaty of peace between the empire and the invading Goths. We have seen that at the moment of Leo's election to the papal see, he was absent in a like mission to reconcile the enmity of the two principal Roman officers, which was threatening the safety of the empire. Yet other and far more important occasions of the same kind fell to the lot of Leo during the term of his bishopric. In 453, Leo was made the head of an embassy to meet Attila as he was on his way to Rome, if possible to turn him back. The embassy was successful. A treaty was formed. Attila retired beyond the Danube, where he immediately died, and Italy was delivered. This redounded no less to the glory of Leo than any of the other remarkable things which he had accomplished. He was not so successful with Genseric 2 years afterward, yet even then he succeeded in mitigating the ravages of the Vandals, which were usually so dreadful. Moreover, it was not against religion as such that the barbarians made war, as they themselves were religious. It was against that mighty empire of which they had seen much and suffered much and heard more that they warred. It was as nations taking vengeance upon a nation which had been so great and which had so proudly asserted lordship over all other nations that they invaded the Roman Empire. And when they could plant themselves and remain as absolute lords in the dominions of those who had boasted of absolute and eternal dominion, and thus humble the pride of the mighty Rome, This was their supreme gratification. As these invasions were not inflicted everywhere at once, but at intervals through a period of 75 years, the Church had ample time to adapt herself to the ways of such of the barbarians as were heathen, which, as ever, she readily did. The heathen barbarians were accustomed to pay the greatest respect to their own priesthood, and were willing to admit the Catholic priesthood to an equal or even a larger place in their estimation. Such of them as were already professedly Christian were Arians, and not so savage as the Catholics. Therefore they, with the exception of the Vandals, were not so ready to persecute, and were willing to settle and make themselves homes in the territories of the vanished empire. At the fall of the empire, the bishopric of Rome was the head and center of a strong and compactly organized power, and by deftly insinuating itself into the place of mediator between the barbarian invaders and the perishing imperial authority, it had attained a position where it was recognized by the invaders as the power which, though it claimed to be not temporal but spiritual, was nonetheless real, and had succeeded to the place of the vanished imperial authority of Rome. And in view of the history of the time, it is impossible to escape the conviction that in the bishopric of Rome there was at this time formed the determination to plant itself in the temporal dominion of Rome and Italy. So long had the emperors been absent from Rome that the bishop of Rome had assumed their place there, and we have seen how the Church had usurped the place of the civil authority. The bishop of Rome was the head of the Church, and now, as the empire was perishing, he would exalt his throne upon its ruins, and out of the anarchy of the times would secure a place and a name among the powers and dominions of the earth. The barbarians who took possession of Italy were Arians, which in the sight of the bishop of Rome was worse than all other crimes put together. In addition to this, the Herulian monarch, Odoacer an Arian, presumed to assert civil authority over the papacy, which on account of the riotous proceedings in the election of the Pope was necessary, but would not meekly be borne by the proud pontiffs. At the election of the first Pope after the fall of the empire, the representative of Odoacer appeared and notified the assembly that without his direction nothing ought to be done, that all they had done was null and void, that the election must begin anew, and that it belonged to the civil magistrate to prevent the disturbances that might arise on such occasions, lest from the Church they should pass to the state. And as these elections were carried not only by violence, but by bribery, in which the property of the Church played an important part, Odoacer, by his lieutenant at this same assembly, A.D. 483, caused a law to be read, forbidding the bishop who should now be chosen, as well as his successors, to alienate any inheritance, possessions, or sacred utensils that now belonged or should for the future belong to the Church, declaring all such bargains void, anathematizing both the seller and the buyer, and obliging the latter and his heirs to restore to the Church all lands and tenements thus purchased, how long soever they might have possessed them. By the law of Constantine, which bestowed upon the Church the privilege of receiving donations, legacies, etc., by will, lands were included, and through nearly 200 years of the working of this law, the Church of Rome had become enormously enriched in landed estates. And more especially, since the extinction of the Western Empire had emancipated the ecclesiastical potentate from secular control, the first and most abiding object of his schemes and prayers had been the acquisition of territorial wealth in the neighborhood of his capital. The Church of Rome had also other lands scattered in different parts of Italy and even in Asia, for Celestine I addressed to Theodosius II a request that he extend his imperial protection over certain estates in Asia, which a woman named Proba had bequeathed to the Church of Rome. As the imperial power faded away in the West, the Bishop of Rome, in his growing power, came more and more to assert his own power of protection over his lands in Italy. And when the imperial power was entirely gone, it was naturally held that this power fell absolutely to him. When therefore Odoacer, both a barbarian invader and a heretic, issued a decree forbidding the alienation of church lands and possessions, this was represented as a presumptuous invasion of the rights of the Bishop of Rome, not only to do what he would with his own, but above all, as protector of the property and estates of the church. For this offense of Odoacer, there was no forgiveness by the Bishop of Rome. Nothing short of the utter uprooting of the Herulian power could atone for it. The Catholic ecclesiastics of Italy began to plot for his overthrow, and it was soon accomplished. There were at that time in the dominions of the Eastern Empire, unsettled and wandering about with no certain dwelling place, the people of the Ostrogoths under King Theodoric. Although in the service of the empire, they were dissatisfied with their lot, and they were so savage and so powerful that the emperor was in constant dread of them. Why might not this force be employed to destroy the dominion of the Heruli and deliver Rome from the interferences and oppression of Odoacer? The suggestion was made to Theodoric by the court, but as he was in the service of the empire, it was necessary that he should have permission to undertake the expedition. He accordingly addressed the emperor as follows: "Although your servant is maintained in affluence by your liberality, graciously listen to the wishes of my heart. Italy, the inheritance of your predecessors, and Rome itself, the head and mistress of the world, now fluctuates under the violence and oppression of Odoacer the mercenary. Direct me, with my national troops, to march against the tyrant. If I fall, you will be relieved from an expensive and troublesome friend. If, with the divine permission, I succeed, I shall govern in your name and to your glory the Roman Senate and the part of the Republic delivered from slavery by my victorious army." Zeno, who was at this time emperor, had already stirred up against Odoacer the nation of the Rugians, and thus it is important to note that already in the year 486, the friendly relations between Odoacer and Zeno had been replaced by scarcely veiled enmity, and thus the mind of the emperor was already tuned to harmony with that fierce harangue against the usurped authority of a king of Rugians and Tursilingians, which, according to Jordanes, Theodoric delivered before him some time in the year 488. The proposition which had been suggested was gladly accepted by the emperor Zeno. Theodoric received a commission to invade Italy, and in the winter of 489, the whole nation of the Ostrogoths took up its march of 700 miles to Italy. The march of Theodoric must be considered as the emigration of an entire people, the wives and children of the Goths, their aged parents, and most precious effects were carefully transported. And at length, surmounting every obstacle by skillful conduct and persevering courage, he descended from the Julian Alps and displayed his invincible banners on the confines of Italy. Theodoric defeated Odoacer in three engagements, AD 489 to 490, and from the Alps to the extremity of Calabria, Theodoric reigned by right of conquest. Odoacer shut himself up in Ravenna, where he sustained himself against a close siege for 3 years. By the offices of the Archbishop of Ravenna and the clamors of the hungry people, Odoacer was brought to sign a treaty of peace, the Archbishop himself acting as mediator. Before Theodoric entered the surrendered city, by a prearranged plan, the Archbishop went forth to meet him, with crosses and thuribles and the Holy Gospels, and with a long train of priests and monks. Falling prostrate on the ground, while his followers sang a penitential psalm, he prayed that the new king from the east would receive him in peace. The request was granted, not only for himself and the citizens of Ravenna, but for all the Roman inhabitants of Italy. A ceremony like this, prearranged in all probability between the king and the archbishop, was judged proper in order to impress vividly on the minds both of Italians and Ostrogoths that Theodoric came as the friend of the Catholic Church and of the vast population which, even in accepting a new master, still clung to the great name of Roman. Soon afterward, at a solemn banquet, Odoacer was slain by the hand of Theodoric himself, and at the same moment and without resistance, his people were universally massacred, March 5, 493, a kind of Sicilian Vespers of the followers of Odoacer all over Italy. And from the sanctimonious manner in which the bishop, Ennodius, Theodoric's panegyrist, claims heaven as an accomplice in the bloody deed, we may perhaps infer that the Roman clergy generally were privy to the plot. Thus was destroyed, plucked up by the roots, the kingdom of Odoacer and the Heruli. And that it was in no small degree the work of the Catholic Church is certain from the further fact that throughout the conquest and establishment of the Gothic kingdom, the increasing power and importance of the Catholic ecclesiastics forces itself upon the attention. They are ambassadors, mediators in treaties. They decide the wavering loyalty or instigate the revolt of cities. The Bishop of Pavia bore to Theodoric at Milan the surrender and offer of allegiance of that great city. Another thing which makes this view most certainly true is the fact that no sooner was order restored in Italy and in Rome, and the Church once more felt itself secure, than a council of 80 bishops, 37 presbyters, and 4 deacons was called in Rome by the Pope, AD 499, the very first act of which was to repeal the law enacted by Odoacer on the subject of the Church possessions. Nor was the law repealed in order to get rid of it, for it was immediately reenacted by the same council. This was plainly to declare that the estates of the Church were no longer subject in any way to the authority of the civil power, but were to be held under the jurisdiction of the Church alone. In fact, it was tantamount to a declaration of the independence of the papacy and her possessions. This transaction also conclusively proves that the resentment of the bishopric of Rome, which had been aroused by the law of Odoacer, was never allayed until Odoacer and the law, so far as it represented the authority of the civil power, were both out of the way. And this is the secret of the destruction of the Herulian kingdom of Italy. It is no argument against this to say that the Ostrogoths were Arians too, because, number one, as we shall presently see, Theodoric, though an Arian, did not interfere with church affairs, and, two, the Church of Rome, in destroying one opponent, never hesitates at the prospect that it is to be done by another, nor that another will arise in the place of the one destroyed. Upon the principle that it is better to have one enemy than two, she will use one to destroy another, and will never miss an opportunity to destroy one for fear that another will arise in its place. Theodoric ruled Italy 38 years, AD 493 to 526, during which time Italy enjoyed such peace and quietness and absolute security as had never been known there before and has never been known since until 1870, and emphatic contrast to the century of creeping paralysis which preceded and to the ghastly cycle of wars and barbarous revenges which followed that peaceful time. The people of his own nation numbered 200,000 men, which, with the proportionate number of women and children, formed a population of nearly 1,000,000. His troops, formerly so wild and given to plunder, were restored to such discipline that in a battle in Dacia, in which they were completely victorious, the rich spoils of the enemy lay untouched at their feet, because their leader had given no signal of pillage. When such discipline prevailed in the excitement of a victory and in an enemy's country, It is easy to understand the peaceful order that prevailed in their own new-gotten lands which the Herulians had held before them. During the ages of violence and revolution which had passed, large tracts of land in Italy had become utterly desolate and uncultivated. Almost the whole of the rest was under imperfect culture. But now, agriculture revived under the shadow of peace, and the number of husbandmen multiplied by the redemption of captives. And Italy, which had so long been fed from other countries, now actually began to export grain. Civil order was so thoroughly maintained that the city gates were never shut either by day or by night, and the common saying that a purse of gold might be safely left in the fields was expressive of the conscious security of the inhabitants. Merchants and other lovers of the blessings of peace thronged from all parts. This they could easily do because his protective power reached even the Burgundians, the Visigoths, and the Alemanni, for the Gothic sovereignty was established from Sicily to the Danube, from Sirmium or Belgrade to the Atlantic Ocean, and the Greeks themselves have acknowledged that Theodoric reigned over the fairest portion of the Western Empire. But not alone did civil peace reign. Above all, there was perfect freedom in the exercise of religion. In fact, the measure of civil liberty and peace always depends upon that of religious liberty. Theodoric and his people were Arians, yet at the close of a 50 years' rule of Italy, the Ostrogoths could safely challenge their enemies to present a single authentic case in which they had ever persecuted the Catholics. Even the mother of Theodoric and some of his favorite Goths had embraced the Catholic faith with perfect freedom from any molestation whatever. The separation between church and state, between civil and religious powers, was clear and distinct. Church property was protected in common with other property, while at the same time it was taxed in common with all other property. The clergy were protected in common with all other people, and they were likewise in common with all other people, cited before the civil courts to answer for all civil offenses. In all ecclesiastical matters, they were left entirely to themselves. Even the papal elections Theodoric left entirely to themselves, and though often solicited by both parties to interfere, he refused to have anything at all to do with them, except to keep the peace, which in fact was of itself no small task. He declined even to confirm the papal elections, an office which had been exercised by Odoacer. Nor was this merely a matter of toleration. It was in genuine recognition of the rights of conscience. In a letter to the Emperor Justin, AD 524, Theodoric announced the genuine principle of the rights of conscience and the relationship that should exist between religion and the state in the following words, worthy to be graven in letters of gold. To pretend to a dominion over the conscience is to usurp the prerogative of God. By the nature of things, the power of sovereigns is confined to political government. They have no right of punishment but over those who disturb the public peace. The most dangerous heresy is that of a sovereign who separates himself from part of his subjects because they believe not according to his belief. Similar pleas had before been made by the parties oppressed, but never before had the principle been announced by the party in power. The enunciation and defense of a principle by the party who holds the power to violate it is the surest pledge that the principle is held in genuine sincerity. The description of the state of peace and quietness in Italy above given applies to Italy, but not to Rome, to the dominions of Theodoric and the Ostrogoths, but not to the city of the Pope and the Catholics. In AD 499 there was a papal election, as there were, as usual, rival candidates, Symmachus and Laurentius. There was a civil war. The two factions encountered with the fiercest hostility. The clergy, the Senate, and the populace were divided. The streets of the city ran with blood, as in the days of Republican strife. The contestants were so evenly matched, and the violent strife continued so long, that the leading men of both parties persuaded the candidates to go to Theodoric at Ravenna and submit to his judgment their claims. Theodoric's love of justice and of the rights of the people readily and simply enough decided that the candidate who had the most votes should be counted elected, and if the votes were evenly divided, then the candidate who had been first ordained. Symmachus secured the office. A council was held by Symmachus, which met the 1st of March 499, and passed a decree almost in the terms of the old Roman law, severely condemning all ecclesiastical ambition, all canvassing either to obtain subscriptions, or administration of oaths, or promises for the papacy, during the lifetime of a pope. But such election methods as these were now so prevalent that this law was of as little value in controlling the methods of the aspiring candidates for the bishopric as in the days of the Republic the same kind of laws were for the candidates to the consulship. Laurentius, though defeated at this time, did not discontinue his efforts to obtain the office. For 4 years he watched for opportunities and carried on an intrigue to displace Symmachus, and in 503 brought a series of heavy charges against him. The accusation was brought before the judgment seat of Theodoric, supported by certain Roman females of rank, who had been suborned, it was said, by the enemies of Symmachus. Symmachus was summoned to Ravenna and confined at Rimini, but escaped and returned to Rome. Meantime, Laurentius had entered the city, and when Symmachus returned, the sanguinary tumults between the two parties broke out with greater fury. Priests were slain, monasteries set on fire, and nuns treated with the utmost indignity. The Senate petitioned Theodoric to send a visitor to judge the cause of Symmachus in the crimes laid against him. The king, finding that the matter was only a church quarrel, appointed one of their own number, the Bishop of Altimo, who so clearly favored Laurentius that his partisanship only made the contention worse. Again Theodoric was petitioned to interfere, but he declined to assume any jurisdiction and told them to settle it among themselves. But as there was so much disturbance of the peace, and it was so long continued, Theodoric commanded them to reach some sort of settlement that would stop their fighting and restore public order. A council was therefore called. As Symmachus was on his way to the council, he was attacked by the adverse party, showers of stones fell upon him, many presbyters and others of his followers were severely wounded, the pontiff himself only escaped under the protection of the Gothic guard and took refuge in the Church of St. Peter. The danger to which he was then exposed, he made an excuse for not appearing at the council. The most of the council were favorable to Symmachus and to the pretensions of the Bishop of Rome at this time, and therefore were glad of any excuse that would relieve them from judging him. However, they went through the form of summoning him 3 times, all of which he declined. Then the council sent deputies to state to Theodoric the condition of affairs, saying to him that the authority of the king might compel Symmachus to appear, but that the council had not such authority. Theodoric replied, "That is your affair, not mine. Had it been my business, I and my good chiefs would have settled it long ago." Further, with respect to the cause of Symmachus, he had assembled them to judge him, but yet left them at full liberty to judge him or not, providing they could by any other means put a stop to the present calamities and restore the wished-for tranquility to the city of Rome. The majority of the council declared Symmachus absolved in the sight of men, whether guilty or innocent in the sight of God, for the reason that no assembly of bishops has power to judge the pope. He is accountable for his actions to God alone. They then commanded all under penalty of excommunication to accept this judgment and submit to the authority of Symmachus and acknowledge him for lawful bishop of the holy city of Rome. Symmachus was not slow to assert all the merit that the council had thus recognized in the bishop of Rome. He wrote to the emperor of the East that a bishop is as much above an emperor as heavenly things which the bishop administers and dispenses are above all the trash of the earth which alone the greatest among the emperors have the power to dispose of. He declared that the higher powers referred to in Romans 13 verse 1 mean the spiritual powers, and that to these it is that every soul must be subject. At another council held in Rome in 504, at the direction of Symmachus, a decree was enacted anathematizing and excluding from the communion of the faithful all who had seized or in the future should seize, hold, or appropriate to themselves the goods or estates of the church, and this decree was declared to extend even to those who held such estates by grants from the crown. This was explicitly to put the authority of the Church of Rome above that of any state. Justin was emperor of the East, AD 518 to 527. He was violently orthodox and was supported by his nephew, the more violently orthodox Justinian. It was the ambition of both, together and in succession, to make the Catholic religion alone prevalent everywhere. They therefore entered with genuine Catholic zeal upon the pious work of clearing their dominions of heretics. The first edict, issued in 523, commanded all Manichaeans to leave the empire under penalty of death, and all other heretics were to be ranked with pagans and Jews and excluded from all public offices. This edict was no sooner learned of in the West than mutterings were heard in Rome of hopes of liberty from the Gothic yoke. The next step was violence. Under the just administration of Theodoric and the safety assured by the Gothic power, many Jews had established themselves in Rome, Genoa, Milan, and other cities for the purposes of trade. They were permitted by express laws to dwell there. As soon as the imperial edict was known, which commanded all remaining heretics to be ranked as pagans and Jews, as the Catholics did not dare to attack the Gothic heretics, they, at Rome and Ravenna especially, riotously attacked the Jews, abused them, robbed them, and burnt their synagogues. A legal investigation was attempted, but the leaders in the riots could not be discovered. Then Theodoric levied a tax upon the whole community of the guilty cities with which to settle the damages. Some of the Catholics refused to pay the tax. They were punished. This at once brought a cry from the Catholics everywhere that they were persecuted. Those who had been punished were glorified as confessors of the faith, and 300 pulpits deplored the persecution of the church. The edict of 523 was followed in 524 by another, this time commanding the Arians of the East to deliver up to the Catholic bishops all their churches, which the Catholic bishops were commanded to consecrate anew. Theodoric addressed an earnest letter to Justin, in which he pleaded for toleration for the Arians from the Eastern Empire. This was the letter in which was stated the principle of the rights of conscience, which we have already quoted on page 192. To this noble plea, however, Justin coolly answered, "I pretend to no authority over men's consciences, but it is my prerogative to entrust the public offices to those in whom I have confidence, and public order demanding uniformity of worship, I have full right to command the churches to be open to those alone who shall conform to the religion of the state. Accordingly, while pretending to no authority over men's consciences, the Arians of his dominions were by Justin stripped of all offices of honor or emolument, were not only expelled from the Catholic churches, but their own were closed against them, and they were exposed to all insults, vexations, and persecutions of their adversaries, who were not likely to enjoy their triumph with moderation or to repress their conscientiously intolerant zeal. Many of them conformed to the state religion, but those of firm faith sent to Theodoric earnest appeals for protection. Theodoric did all that he could, but without avail. He was urged to retaliate by persecuting the Catholics in Italy, but he steadfastly refused. He determined to send an embassy to Justin, and most singularly sent the Pope as his ambassador. No two pieces on the political chessboard ought, for the safety of his kingdom, to have been kept farther apart from one another than the Pope and the Emperor. And now, by his own act, he brings these pieces close together. The Pope, attended by 5 other bishops and 4 senators, set forth on a mission of which it was the ostensible object to obtain indulgence for heretics, heretics under the ban of his church, heretics looked upon with the most profound detestation. This arrangement gave to the Bishop of Rome the most perfect opportunity he could have asked to form a compact with the imperial authority of the East for the further destruction of the Ostrogothic kingdom. The Pope, John I, was received in Constantinople with the most flattering honors, as though he had been St. Peter himself. The whole city, with the emperor at its head, came forth to meet him with tapers and torches as far as 10 miles beyond the gates. The emperor knelt at his feet and implored his benediction. On Easter Day, March 3525, he performed the service in the great church, Epiphanius the bishop ceding the first place to the holy stranger. Such an embassy could have no other result than more than ever to endanger the kingdom of Theodoric. Before John's return, the conspiracy became more manifest. Some senators and leading men were arrested. One of them, Boethius, though denying his guilt, boldly confessed, "Had there been any hopes of liberty, I should have freely indulged them. Had I known of a conspiracy against the king, I should have answered in the words of a noble Roman to the frantic Caligula, 'You would not have known it from me.'" Such a confession as that was almost a confession of the guilt which he denied. He and his father-in-law were executed. When the Pope returned, he was received as a traitor and put in prison, where he died May 18, 526. He was no sooner dead than violent commotion and disturbances again arose amongst rival candidates for the vacant chair. Many candidates appeared for the vacant see, and the whole city, the Senate as well as the people and clergy, were divided into parties and factions, the papal dignity being now as eagerly sought for and often obtained by the same methods and arts as the consular was in the times of the heathen. Theodoric, now 74 years old, fearing that these contentions would end in murder and bloodshed again, as they had at the election of Symmachus, suffered his authority to transcend his principles and presumed himself to name a bishop of Rome. The whole people of the city, Senate, clergy, and all, united in opposition. But a compromise was effected by which it was agreed that in future the election of the Pope should be by the clergy and people, but must be confirmed by the sovereign. Upon this understanding, the people accepted Theodoric's nominee, and July 12, 526, Felix III was installed in the papal office. The noble Theodoric died August 30, 526, and was succeeded by his grandson, Athalaric, about 10 years old, under the regency of his mother, Amalasontha. Justin died and was succeeded by Justinian, August 1, 527, to November 14, 565. In the establishment of the ecclesiastical empire, Justinian holds the like place that Constantine and Theodosius occupy in the establishment of the Catholic Church. Among the titles of greatness, the name pious was most pleasing to his ears. To promote the temporal and spiritual interests of the Church was the serious business of his life, and the duty of father of his country was often sacrificed to that of defender of the faith. The Emperor Justinian unites in himself the most opposite vices, insatiable rapacity and lavish prodigality, intense pride and contemptible weakness, unmeasured ambition and dastardly cowardice. In the Christian emperor seem to meet the crimes of those who won or secured their empire by assassination of all whom they feared, the passion for public diversions without the accomplishments of Nero or the brute strength of Commodus, the dotage of Claudius. Pope Felix was succeeded by Boniface II, A.D. 530 to 532, who was chosen amidst the now customary scenes of disturbance and strife, which in this case was brought to an end, and the election of Boniface secured by the death of his rival, who after his death was excommunicated by Boniface. On account of the shameful briberies and other methods of competition employed in the election of the popes, the Roman Senate now enacted a law declaring null and execrable all promises, bargains, and contracts, by whomsoever or for whomsoever made, with a view to engage suffrages in the election of the Pope, and excluding forever from having any share in the election such as should be found to have been directly or indirectly concerned, either for themselves or others, in contracts or bargains of that nature. Laws of the same import had already been enacted more than once, but they amounted to nothing, because, as in the days of Caesar, everybody was ready to bribe or be bribed. Accordingly, at the very next election in 532, votes were publicly bought and sold, and notwithstanding the decree lately issued by the Senate, money was offered to the senators themselves. Nay, the lands of the church were mortgaged by some, and the sacred utensils pawned by others or publicly sold for ready money. As the result of 75 days of this kind of work, a certain John Mercurius was made pope and took the title of John II, December 31, 532. In the year 532, Justinian issued an edict declaring his intention to unite all men in one faith. Whether they were Jews, Gentiles, or Christians, all who did not within 3 months profess and embrace the Catholic faith were by the edict declared infamous and as such excluded from all employments both civil and military, rendered incapable of leaving anything by will, and all their estates confiscated, whether real or personal. As a result of this cruel edict, great numbers were driven from their habitations with their wives and children, stripped and naked. Others betook themselves to flight, carrying with them what they could conceal for their support and maintenance, but they were plundered of what little they had, and many of them inhumanly massacred. There now occurred a transaction which meant much in the supremacy of the papacy. It was brought about in this way. Ever since the Council of Chalcedon had settled the question of the two natures in Christ, there had been more and more violent contentions over it than ever before. For everywhere monks were at the head of the religious revolution which threw off the yoke of the Council of Chalcedon. In Jerusalem, a certain Theodosius was at the head of the army of monks, who made him bishop, and in acts of violence, pillage, and murder, he fairly outdid the perfectly lawless bandits of the country. The very scenes of the Savior's mercies ran with bloodshed in his name by his ferocious, self-called disciples. In Alexandria, the bishop was not only murdered in the baptistry, but his body was treated with shameless indignities, and other enormities were perpetrated which might have appalled a cannibal. and the monkish horde then elected as bishop one of their own number, Timothy the Weasel, a disciple of Dioscorus. Soon there was added to all this another point which increased the fearful warfare. In the Catholic churches it was customary to sing what was called the Trisagion, or Thrice Holy. It was originally the Holy, Holy, Holy is the Lord of Hosts of Isaiah 6, verse 3. But at the time of the Council of Chalcedon, it had been changed and was used by the council thus: Holy God, Holy Almighty, Holy Immortal, have mercy on us. In Antioch in 477, a third monk, Peter the Fuller, led a procession chiefly of monastics through the streets, loudly singing the Thrice Holy, with the addition, Who wast crucified for us? It was orthodox to sing it as the Council of Chalcedon had used it, with the understanding that the three holies referred respectively to the three persons of the Trinity. It was heresy to sing it with the later addition. In AD 511, two hordes of monks on the two sides of the question met in Constantinople. The two black-cowled armies watched each other for several months, working in secret on their respective partisans. At length, they came to a rupture. The Monophysite monks in the Church of the Archangel within the palace broke out after the Thrice Holy with the burden added at Antioch by Peter the Fuller, who was crucified for us. The Orthodox monks, backed by the rabble of Constantinople, endeavored to expel them from the church. They were not content with hurling curses against each other. Sticks and stones began their work. There was a wild, fierce fray. The divine presence of the emperor lost its awe. He could not maintain the peace. The bishop Macedonius either took the lead or was compelled to lead the tumult. Men, women, and children poured out from all quarters. The monks with their archimandrites at the head of the raging multitude echoed back their religious war cry. These are but samples of the repeated, it might almost be said, the continuous occurrences in the cities of the East. Throughout Asiatic Christendom, it was the same wild struggle. Bishops deposed quietly, or where resistance was made, the two factions fighting in the streets, in the churches, cities, even the holiest places, ran with blood. The hymn of the angels in heaven was the battle cry on earth, the signal of human bloodshed. In AD 512, one of these Trisagion riots broke out in Constantinople because the emperor proposed to use the added clause. Many palaces of the nobles were set on fire, the officers of the crown were insulted, pillage, conflagration, violence raged through the city. In the house of the favorite minister of the emperor, there was found a monk from the country. He was accused of having suggested the use of the addition. His head was cut off and raised high on a pole, and the whole Orthodox populace marched through the streets singing the Orthodox Trisagion and shouting, Behold the enemy of the Trinity! In AD 519, another dispute was raised growing out of the addition to the Trisagion. That was, did one of the Trinity suffer in the flesh, or did one person of the Trinity suffer in the flesh? The monks of Scythia affirmed that one of the Trinity suffered in the flesh and declared that to say that one person of the Trinity suffered in the flesh was absolute heresy. The question was brought before Pope Hormisdas, who decided that to say that one person of the Trinity suffered in the flesh was the Orthodox view, and denounced the monks as proud, arrogant, obstinate, enemies to the church, disturbers of the public peace, slanderers, liars, and instruments employed by the enemy of truth to banish all truth, to establish error in its room, and to sow among the wheat the poisonous seeds of diabolical tares. Now in 533, this question was raised again, and Justinian became involved in the dispute. This time, one set of monks argued that If one of the Trinity did not suffer on the cross, then one of the Trinity was not born of the Virgin Mary, and therefore she ought no longer to be called the Mother of God. Others argued, if one of the Trinity did not suffer on the cross, then Christ who suffered was not one of the Trinity. Justinian entered the lists against both and declared that Mary was truly the Mother of God, that Christ was, in the strictest sense, one of the Trinity, and that whosoever denied either the one or the other was a heretic. This frightened the monks, because they knew Justinian's opinions on the subject of heretics were exceedingly forcible. They therefore sent off two of their number to lay the question before the Pope. As soon as Justinian learned this, he too decided to apply to the Pope. He therefore drew up a confession of faith that one of the Trinity suffered in the flesh and sent it by two bishops to the Bishop of Rome. To make his side of the question appear as favorable as possible to the Pope, Justinian sent a rich present of chalices and other vessels of gold enriched with precious stones, and the following flattering letter. Justinian, pious, fortunate, renowned, triumphant, emperor, consul, etc., to John, the most holy archbishop of our city of Rome and patriarch, rendering honor to the apostolic chair and to your holiness, as has been always and is our wish, and honoring your blessedness as a father, we have hastened to bring to the knowledge of your holiness all matters relating to the state of the churches. It having been at all times our great desire to preserve the unity of your apostolic chair and the constitution of the holy churches of God, which has obtained hitherto and still obtains. Therefore, we have made no delay in subjecting and uniting to your holiness all the priests of the whole East. For this reason, we have thought fit to bring to your notice the present matters of disturbance, though they are manifest and unquestionable, and always firmly held and declared by the whole priesthood according to the doctrine of your apostolic chair. For we cannot suffer that anything which relates to the state of the church, however manifest and unquestionable, should be moved without the knowledge of your holiness, who are the head of all the holy churches. For in all things we have already declared we are anxious to increase the honor and authority of your apostolic chair. All things were now ready for the complete deliverance of the Catholic Church from Arian dominion. Since the death of Theodoric, divided councils had crept in amongst the Ostrogoths, and the Catholic Church had been more and more cementing to its interests the powers of the Eastern throne. Constant amicable intercourse was still taking place between the Catholic clergy of the East and the West, between Constantinople and Rome, between Justinian and the rapid succession of pontiffs who occupied the throne during the 10 years between the death of Theodoric and the invasion of Italy. The crusade began with the invasion of the Arian kingdom of the Vandals in Africa, of whom Gelimer was the king, and was openly and avowedly in the interests of the Catholic religion and church. For in a council of his ministers, nobles, and bishops, Justinian was dissuaded from undertaking the African war. He hesitated and was about to relinquish his design when he was rallied by a fanatical bishop who exclaimed, I have seen a vision. It is the will of heaven, O emperor, that you should not abandon your holy enterprise for the deliverance of the African church. The God of battle will march before your standard and disperse your enemies, who are the enemies of his son. This persuasion was sufficient for the pious emperor, and in June 533 the whole fleet of 600 ships was ranged in martial pomp before the gardens of the palace, laden and equipped with 35,000 troops and sailors and 5,000 horses, all under the command of Belisarius. He landed on the coast of Africa in September. Carthage was captured on the 18th of the same month. Gelimer was disastrously defeated in November, and the conquest of Africa and the destruction of the Vandal kingdom were completed by the capture of Gelimer in the spring of 534. During the rest of the year, Belisarius reduced the islands of Corsica, Sardinia, Majorca, Minorca, and whatever else belonged to the Vandals, either on the continent or in the islands. Belisarius dispatched to Justinian the news of his victory. He received the messengers of victory at the time when he was preparing to publish the Pandects of the Roman law, and the devout or jealous emperor celebrated the divine goodness and confessed in silence the merit of his successful general. Impatient to abolish the temporal and spiritual tyranny of the Vandals, he proceeded without delay to the full establishment of the Catholic Church. Her jurisdiction, wealth, and immunities, perhaps the most essential part of episcopal religion, were restored and amplified with a liberal hand. The Arian worship was suppressed, the Donatist meetings were proscribed, and the Synod of Carthage, by the voice of 217 bishops, applauded the just measure of pious retaliation. In the summer of 534, Belisarius returned to Constantinople, taking with him the captive Gelimer and the small remnant of Vandals who remained yet alive. He was awarded a triumph which, for near 600 years, had never been enjoyed by any but an emperor. As Gelimer followed in the train of his captor and came into the hippodrome and saw Justinian sitting on his throne and the ranks and orders of the Roman people standing on either side of him, he repeated again and again the words of the kingly Hebrew preacher, "Vanity of vanities, all is vanity." He was suffered to live and was given large estates in the Galatian province and lived there in peace with his exiled kinsfolk. Also among the spoils of Vandal conquest carried that day in grand triumphal procession were the golden candlestick and other sacred vessels of the Temple of God, which had been carried to Rome by Titus and had graced his triumph after the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. They had been taken by Genseric in his sack of Rome in 455, and were carried by him to Carthage, where they remained till the capture of that city by Belisarius and his return in triumph to Constantinople. There that day a Jew, seeing them, said to a friend of the emperor's, "If those vessels are brought into the palace, they will cause the ruin of this empire. They have already brought the Vandal to Rome and Belisarius to Carthage, nor will Constantinople long wait for her conqueror if they remain here." This word coming to Justinian, he took warning and sent the sacred vessels to Jerusalem, whence they had been carried more than 600 years before, and where they were now stored up in one of the Christian churches. As soon as this pious work of uprooting the Vandal kingdom had been fully accomplished, the arms of Justinian were turned against Italy and the Arian Ostrogoths. In 534, Amalasontha had been supplanted in her rule over the Ostrogoths by her cousin Theodotus. And during the short and troubled reign of Theodotus, 534 to 536, Justinian received petitions from all parts of Italy and from all persons, lay as well as clerical, with the air and tone of its sovereign. Belisarius subdued Sicily in 535 and invaded Italy and captured Naples in 536. As it was now about the 1st of December, the Gothic warriors decided to postpone until the following spring their resistance to the invaders. A garrison of 4,000 soldiers was left in Rome, a feeble number to defend such a city at such a time in any case, but these troops proved to be even more feeble in faith than they were in numbers. They threw over all care of the city and furiously exclaimed that the apostolic throne should no longer be profaned by the triumph or toleration of Arianism, that the tombs of the Caesars should no longer be trampled by the savages of the north, and without reflecting that Italy must sink into a province of Constantinople, they fondly hailed the restoration of a Roman emperor as a new era of freedom and prosperity. The deputies of the Pope and clergy, of the Senate and people, invited the lieutenant of Justinian to accept their voluntary allegiance and to enter into the city, whose gates would be thrown open to his reception. Belisarius at once marched to Rome. Vitiges, the king of the Goths, not thinking himself in a condition to defend the city against his victorious army, left 4,000 chosen troops in it, and withdrew with the rest to Ravenna. Having first exhorted Pope Silvarius and the Senate, says Procopius, to continue steady in their allegiance to the Goths, who had deserved so well of them and their city. But he was no sooner gone than the Senate, at the persuasion of the Pope, invited Belisarius to come and take possession of the city, which he did accordingly. The Goths, who could not make head at the same time against the enemy without, and the citizens within the walls retiring by the Flaminian, while the Romans entered by the Asinarian gate. Thus was the city of Rome reunited to the empire on the 10th of December of the present year 536, after it had been separated from it 80 years. But the taking of Rome was not the destruction of the nation of the Ostrogoths. It was not the uprooting of the Ostrogothic kingdom. From their rustic habitations, from their different garrisons, the Goths assembled at Ravenna for the defense of their country, and such were their numbers that, after an army had been detached for the relief of Dalmatia, 150,000 fighting men marched under the royal standard in the spring AD 537, and the Gothic nation returned to the siege of Rome and the defense of Italy against the invaders. The whole nation of the Ostrogoths had been assembled for the attack, and was almost entirely consumed in the siege of Rome, which continued above a year, 537 to 538. 1 year and 9 days after the commencement of the siege, an army so lately strong and triumphant burnt their tents and tumultuously repassed the Milvian Bridge, and Rome was delivered March 12, 538. With heavy hearts, the barbarians must have thought as they turned them northward upon the many graves of gallant men which they were leaving on that fatal plain, some of them must have suspected the melancholy truth that they had dug one grave, deeper and wider than all, the grave of the Gothic monarchy in Italy. The remains of the kingdom were soon afterward destroyed. They had lost their king, an inconsiderable loss, their capital, their treasures, their provinces from Sicily to the Alps, and the military force of 200,000 barbarians, magnificently equipped with horses and arms. And thus was the kingdom of the Ostrogoths destroyed before the vengeful arrogance of the papacy. This completely opened the way for the Bishop of Rome to assert his sole authority over the estates of the Church. The district immediately surrounding Rome was called the Roman Duchy, and it was so largely occupied by the estates of the Church that the Bishop of Rome claimed exclusive authority over it. The emperor indeed continued to control the elections and to enforce the payment of tribute for the territory protected by the imperial arms. But on the other hand, the pontiff exercised a definite authority within the Roman duchy and claimed to have a voice in the appointment of the civil officers who administered the local government. Under the protectorate of the armies of the East, which soon merged in the Exarch of Ravenna, the papacy enlarged its aspirations, confirmed its powers, and strengthened its situation both spiritually and temporally. Being by the decrees of the councils and the homage of the emperor made the head of all ecclesiastical and spiritual dominion on earth, and being now in possession of territory and exerting a measure of civil authority therein, the opportunity that now fell to the ambition of the bishopric of Rome was to assert, to gain, and to exercise supreme authority in all things temporal as well as spiritual. And the sanction of this aspiration was made to accrue from Justinian's letter, in which he rendered such distinctive honor to the apostolic see. It is true that Justinian wrote these words with no such far-reaching meaning, but that made no difference. The words were written, and like all other words of similar import, they could be and were made to bear whatever meaning the Bishop of Rome should choose to find in them. Therefore, the year AD 538, which marks the conquest of Italy, the deliverance of Rome, and the destruction of the kingdom of the Ostrogoths, is the true date which marks the establishment of the temporal authority of the papacy and the exercise of that authority as a world power. All that was ever done later in this connection was but to enlarge by additional usurpations and donations the territories which the Bishop of Rome at this point possessed, and over which he asserted civil jurisdiction. This view is fully sustained by the following excellent statement of the case. The conquest of Italy by the Greeks was, to a great extent at least, the work of the Catholic clergy. The overthrow of the Gothic kingdom was to Italy an unmitigated evil. A monarch like Witigis or Totila would soon have repaired the mischiefs caused by the degenerate successors of Theodoric, Athalaric, and Theodotus. In their overthrow began the fatal policy of the Roman See, which never would permit a powerful native kingdom to unite Italy, or a very large part of it, under one dominion. Whatever it may have been to Christendom, the papacy has been the eternal, implacable foe of Italian independence and Italian unity, and so, as far as independence and unity might have given dignity, political weight, and prosperity, to the welfare of Italy. Then began that fatal policy of the Roman See, because she was then herself a world power, possessing temporalities over which she both claimed and exercised dominion, and by virtue of which she could contend with other dominions and upon the same level. And that which made the papacy so much the more domineering in this fatal policy was the fact of Justinian's having so fully committed himself. When the mightiest emperor who had ever sat on the eastern throne had not only under his own hand rendered such decided homage to the papacy, but had rooted out the last power that stood in her way, this to her was strongly justifiable ground for her assertion of dominion over all other dominions and her disputing dominion with the powers of the earth.